Thanks. We're in an island family. I wonder how many of you enjoyed the public holiday on Monday? How many people took time to recently to reflect on the death of Queen Elizabeth II? I saw in the paper yesterday that new coins have been designed which reflect that King Charles III is now King of the United Kingdom and 14 other Commonwealth realms. This may not actually impact our daily lives that much. However, as Kathleen has so beautifully read for us, the life of Hadassah, or Esther as we know her, was greatly impacted by the king who was in power at that time, King Ahasuerus, also known as King Xerxes. Here's a coin image with a coin with an image of King Xerxes on the screen, hopefully. In this talk, I'll firstly take a look at the setting that Esther found herself in and how this influences the events going forward. Then we'll look at the characters that are introduced to us in Esther 1 and 2 and identify some of their qualities, which will no doubt be developed as the story continues. Lastly, we'll think about a hidden message in the book of Esther and what we can take from it for our lives today. So this story hones in on a Jewish community living in Susa, the capital city of the Persian Empire. This takes place around 100 years after the Babylonian exile, so some of the Jews like Ezra and Nehemiah have returned to Jerusalem, and a remnant of Jewish people remain in Susa. Rachel Held Evans wrote an interesting series about Esther, and she pointed out that the absence of a temple and a homeland during this time raised some serious questions for the Jews about what it meant to be the people of God, particularly under the rule of pagan kings. If you think about it, the central focal point for Jewish people up until the exile was the temple, and they related to God through the system of sacrifices at the temple, which enabled them to worship God. Without this focal point, it would have been difficult for them to consider how to relate to God as a community, particularly as their community was scattered, fragmented, and persecuted. The book of Esther has an anonymous author, although it is assumed that the author is Jewish because of the Jewish nationalism which permeates the story, and also the emphasis on the origin of Purim, a Jewish festival. The author's knowledge of Persian customs suggests that he was a resident of a Persian city. Perhaps some people suggest that it could have been Mordecai who wrote Esther. The book is modelled after the story of Joseph. Both of these accounts are set in the courts of foreign monarchs and show Israelite heroes who rise to prominence and provide salvation for their people. The purpose of the book is to explain the festival of Purim, and the Hebrew word for dice is pur. So later in the story, when Haman throws the dice to work out which day the Jews are going to be executed, so that's what that's based on. Spoiler alert. Yeah, so I won't give too much away, but so in chapter 1, we see that King Xerxes ruled over 127 territories. Let's see if I can work this. There we go. The Message version of the Bible describes this area as stretching from India to Ethiopia. And verses 1 to 8 describe the opulent wealth of his empire, or as one commentator puts it, the vainglory of his empire. The blue and white linen banners described in verse 6 are significant in that these are the royal colours of Persia. Another thing we notice in these first 8 verses is that everything belongs to the king. 9 times we are told that something is his kingdom, his rule, his royal throne, his nobles, his territories, his guests, his servants. In verse 9, we notice that while the king is entertaining his guests in the garden, Queen Vashti gave a feast of her own. There's some artwork there. So what is this? A little bit of independence from the king, giving a feast of her own. And where was Queen Vashti's feast held? In the royal palace of King Xerxes. So everything is his in this world. In fact, Persian custom dictated that there was no mixed dancing, so it was not the custom for the Persians for women to appear in public, which provides an explanation for the women having their own separate feast. Another explanation given is that this was a political move on Vashti's part, and that if things went awry in the men's feast, the women would become hostages. Who knows? So we don't have to delve very far into the story of Esther to see that this power, pomp, and sense of ownership has a much more sinister side. The Greek historian Herodotus wrote 25 years after the reign of Xerxes and provides some insight into Xerxes' might and cruelty. This includes the fact that each year 500 young boys were gathered from the kingdom to serve as eunuchs in the Persian court. Rachel Held Evans acknowledges that Esther's body and the bodies of the eunuchs and the bodies of the women brought into the harem were the property of the empire. Michael Fox has written about character and ideology in the book of Esther and states that everyone's sexuality, and not only the woman's, was at the king's disposal. He goes on to say that what is most significant and most oppressive is that their will and feelings, whatever they might have been, is of no interest to anyone in the story. Their bodies are seen as belonging to others, so much so that they are not even pictured as being forced. Let's take a moment now to think about some of the characteristics displayed by King Xerxes up to this point. In this slide, I've tried to move beyond some of the simplistic descriptions of a character like old or young, rich or poor, beautiful or ugly, and look at some words that we could think about the characteristics of the different people in the book of Esther. So knowing what we know now about King Xerxes and the setting of the Persian Empire, we may wonder why it was that Vashti refused to listen to the king and appear before him at the feast when he commanded her to do so in verse 11. I found some fascinating ideas in the Jewish Women's Archive in answer to this question. The first idea has already been alluded to, which is that strict Persian laws regarding modesty would have prohibited Vashti from presenting herself to a group of men. So perhaps Vashti refused the king in obedience to a higher law. Some less generous commentators suggest that she was unhappy with her appearance at the time, suffering with leprosy. Others say she was capricious, and some say Vashti was asserting her rights in a feminist manner before her time. We may never know Vashti's reasoning behind her decision. However, we do know that the king lost his temper over it in verse 12. There we are. Matthew Henry describes this very fittingly. He that had rule over 127 provinces had no rule over his own spirit, but his anger burned in him. Interestingly, in verse 10, Xerxes is referred to simply as Xerxes rather than King Xerxes, suggesting a loss of respect for the king because of his actions. Maybe you'll see that he considers the advice of his advisors when he's sort of in his anger, and then he's quite pleased with the advice and he follows the advice, although later he regrets that he did that, followed that advice rashly, and he wishes that he could have Vashti back, but the law of the Medes and Persians cannot be changed, so once that's been made into law, that couldn't be reversed. So, where are we? In the story of Esther, let's consider Queen Vashti. What characteristics do we observe in Vashti based on her actions in the story so far? Oops. There we are. In the story of Esther, the characters are not necessarily put forward as role models for us to follow. Instead, we are aware of their humanity, and we may notice a complex mixture of character qualities within each person. The next character to be introduced in chapter 2 is Mordecai. Here we are. Straight away, we learn about his whakapapa, which connects him in the bigger story of how God has interacted with the Jewish people over the years. It is significant that Mordecai is from the tribe of Benjamin and a descendant of Kish, who is the father of King Saul. He's also descended from Shimei, who famously cursed King David in 2 Samuel 16, 11 to 12, blaming David for Saul's death. We don't learn anything about Mordecai's role in the Persian Empire at this point in the story, but we do learn that he's shown tender care to his cousin Esther by adopting her and raising her as his own daughter. We see in verse 11 that he is concerned for her welfare. Although perhaps he is also ambitious for his own influence with the king to be enhanced if Esther becomes a favourite with the king. Let's consider which of Mordecai's character attributes we are aware of at this point. More may be revealed as the story continues. Now let's think about Hadassah, as she would have been known to her family, or Esther. She is one of the children of the Babylonian captivity. She's also a vulnerable orphan. Matthew Henry states that when her father and mother had forsaken her, or when they had died, the Lord took her up. We see in chapter 2, verse 10, that she respects Mordecai and follows his instructions regarding not revealing her Jewish identity to anyone. Sorry, lost it. Quite a long passage, isn't it? Maybe I'll get Jess, if you don't mind, to find chapter 2, verse 10. Thinking back to her context, it would be unthinkable for Esther to consider defying her male guardian, or even worse, the Persian Empire. Thank you. To survive, she needed to follow the script written for her. She's remembered for her beauty, although, according to Matthew Henry, her wisdom and virtue were her greatest beauty, although he does qualify this by saying it is an advantage for a diamond to be well set. We see in verse 9 that Hegai, the chief eunuch in charge of the king's harem, is pleased with Esther and provides her with special food. This is reminiscent of Daniel in Daniel 1, 8 to 15. Daniel did not eat the rich food provided for him by King Nebuchadnezzar, but instead ate vegetables and drank only water. We are not given any detail about the special food provided for Esther and whether or not this would have been, would have been food that prevented her from being unclean according to Jewish law. We don't know. We also notice in verse 15 that when it's Esther's turn to go to the king, she does not take advantage of the one choice given to her, where she could take any item that she wanted with her into the king's palace. Here we are. Esther takes only what is suggested by Hegai, the official in charge of her care. So which character qualities do we observe in Esther at this point in the story? There is one character in the book of Esther, who's never referred to by name. Sorry, we can go back to that one. Thank you. He's never referred to by name. In the original version of the book, no name, title, or pronoun for God appears. This is actually an invitation for the reader to read the story looking for God's activity throughout. Matthew Henry says that though the name of God is not in this book, the finger of God is directing many minute events for the bringing about of his people's deliverance. The instruments of this intended deliverance are Esther and Mordecai. In the words of Rachel Held Evans, Esther is a book about how to live with your community in a place which is indifferent or hostile to you. While on one level this book explains the Jewish festival of Purim, a deeper purpose also underlies the book, which is demonstrating God's sovereignty and concern for his people. When God seems absent and oppression is very present, we can trust that God has not abandoned us or abandoned his redemptive purposes and promises. We can trust the king of a very different kingdom than that of King Xerxes, a kingdom that doesn't proclaim itself with pomp and power, but which rises like yeast and dough in the most unlikely places amongst oppressed people at the margins of society. Thank you.